Good afternoon. Thank you very much for this introduction. I have to say that I'm very grateful and honored to present today some elements of my research. I would like to first and foremost warmly thank Professor Anchan for inviting me to speak at this symposium, despite my being a very young scholar who just hatched out his doctoral studies. So today I will present you a paper, some key features of Chinese intellectual outlook toward India at the beginning of 20th century China, especially during the May 4th era. I should also mention that this paper is part of a bigger project I'm involved in, which is trying to map the different concepts and discourse concerning the issue of civilization and culture in early 20th century China. Indeed, before jumping into the topic, I would like to underline the fact that the question of Chinese outlook toward Indian culture in early 20th century China is a topic whose key elements and intellectual challenges go well beyond the simple topic of the relationship between China and India. Therefore, I would like first to raise several issues that can broaden our intellectual horizon and help us grasp why one should pay attention to the Chinese discourse on India. The first issue I want to raise is that by decentering the classical problem of from what the Chinese thought of the West to what the Chinese thought of India, I believe that we can free ourselves from very strong historiographical bias. I am here mainly thinking about the Levinson narrative of the history of modern China. In 1968, the American sinologist Joseph Levinson wrote a three-volume book entitled Confucian China and Its Modern Fate, a great book with which generations of scholars have worked with and now are working against. In his very rich analysis of the intellectual life of China at the end of 19th century, Levinson comes up with, I believe, two key ideas. First, there is a contradiction between Chinese cultural identity and modernity, and then Chinese nationalism emerged as a denial of culturalism. It seems to me that this framework irrigated much of the research being done on the relationship between China and India. In his address at the 66th session of the Indian History Congress, Professor Kamal Shil advocated that the earliest Chinese discourses on India were based on a recognition of the latter as the land of an equally civilized culture. In contrast, the modern Chinese discourses emanate from the framework of nation-states. For Shil, Chinese discourses on India as a failed other are but a modern product that emanated from the construct of nationalism in late imperial China. To put it in other words, the emergence of the political concept such as state or nation displaces the Chinese outlook on India. However, I am of the opinion that in defending this position, Shil ignored the fact that an important part of the vocabulary to speak about what we would nowadays call culture or civilization was developed later than, or at least simultaneously with, the vocabulary to speak of nationalism. Speaking of equally civilized culture is here an anachronism, or at least a transformation of Chinese discourse into our contemporary categories. Shil considered that the emergence of the modern vocabulary of the nation affected the Chinese outlook on India. But he forgets that there was no modern vocabulary of culture and civilization before the end of 19th century or even later. The classic opposition between the French La Civilisation and the German Die Kultur was only solidified during the First World War. Therefore, I believe we have to be very careful when analyzing the discourse of the Chinese intellectual and focus on the concept they were using. If by the end of Qing Dynasty, the Chinese intellectual realized that they were part of an internationalized world with a new center in various ages, and a system in which nation had to compete for survival, maybe they were also aware of the fact that the world was populated by many different cultures or civilization. Therefore, questioning Chinese intellectual discourse on Indian culture can also help us to disentangle modern Chinese intellectual history from the cultural identity versus westernization perspective. The path for a new China were not limited to these two options. One could, for instance, Indianize China. Incidentally, in 1924, during the visit of Rabindranath Tagore in China, Chen Duxiu complained that Tagore was trying to Indianize the Chinese youth. Furthermore, questioning Chinese discourse on India raised the issue of the very possibility of a connected intellectual history that would bring together non-European words. I am of the opinion that we should take seriously the challenge raised by Pankaj Mishra in his book From the Ruins of Empire, and consider whether the intellectual from non-European countries were not only concerned by the same problems, but at some point may have coordinated their response. Integrating India in the Chinese debate about culture and civilization implies not only to consider how Chinese look at India, but also how they consider Indian intellectuals' attack against the Western civilization. Now, did the Chinese enemies of the West found friends among the Indians? That is a question one could ask. To give an example, did the Chinese were aware of Gandhi's denunciation of Western civilization in his, please pardon my Gujarati, in Swaraj, Indian Home Rule? Tagore in China is here a very well-known topic, but he was far from being alone in his attack against the West. So can we find Chinese readers and admirers of Indian intellectuals in the early 20th century? That is a question worth asking. The final key issue that I want to raise, and that will serve me as a guideline for the rest of my presentation, is the sustainability of a notion such as the East, or the problem of reverse Orientalism. Like their Western counterparts, many Chinese intellectuals were keen on erecting a strong division between the East and the West. On this slide, you can read a key exponent of this theory, Li Dajiao. This is a text of 1918. In this text, Li defined the West as a civilization of activism and the East as a civilization of quietism. He gives a series of binary opposition. I don't think you don't even need to know Chinese to see how the text is constructed. One is like this, the other one is with the opposing category. Here is a translation. So, for us 21st century scholars, this list of opposing qualities, and even we could say opposing cliché, raised a key question. What does the East-West dichotomy mean in the eye of a Chinese intellectual at the beginning of 20th century? I believe we all have read Edouard Said, and we are aware that the East was but an intellectual construction of Europeans. The East was elaborated as a mirror for Europeans to contemplate or judge themselves. But when a Chinese scholar was presenting himself as an Easterner, was he bringing forward a similar project? Was he even associating himself with the people of other parts of the world? To go further in this problem, let us take a look at a very famous text from Chen Duxiu. Here, in using the term East, Chen tending to think first and foremost about China. It is something very obvious in the rhetoric. In the first part of the quote, he gives a quality to the West and an opposing quality to the East. Westerners are warmongers, Easterners only seek peace. Here, Chen Duxiu regards the Chinese, the Indians, and the Jews as Easterners. However, when he mentions the many people of the East, China always comes first. And as you can see on the slide, he speaks a lot more about China than the other countries. So in the end, the difference between the different people of Asia were neglected. His example had a very strong emphasis on China. Another feature of Chen texts that could be underscored is the fact that he mentions the Jews before the Indians. Why so? If Chen spoke first of what he knew best, of course, it is obvious that he knows a lot about China. Why did he put the Jew before the Indians? He should be knowing a bit more about India than about the Jewish people. However, in most other texts of that time, this classification, putting India at the back places in the list, was very common. In the text of Li Dajiao that I just quote, when Li Dajiao was listing the many countries of the Eastern civilization, India was located after Indochina, Malaysia, and Myanmar. Was this order a way to belittle Indian culture? After this long series of interrogation, the importance of Chinese intellectual discourse on India appears obvious. At the beginning of 20th century, did the Chinese intellectuals comfort themselves in the narrative that India was, as Sheol coined it, a failed other? Or did they engage in a serious reflection on Indian culture? Furthermore, was an opposition between the proponent of westernization and the proponent of tradition also apparent in their attitude toward India? In 1924, Professor Qinping Yuan wrote an article on Xu Dishan and Indian culture. In this article, he writes that during the May 4th era, the traditionalists were the biggest proponents of Indian culture, and they carried forward the idea that India was a representative of Eastern civilization, not only in order to defend the Chinese national quintessence, but also to fight the new culture movement. However, was it really so, and especially on these terms? In fact, more largely, did Indian culture play any role in the debate about westernization? At first, I had planned to start by recapitulating the position of several key intellectuals of the late Qing dynasty. Unfortunately, for timetable reason, I will jump quickly toward the text written during the May 4th era. I should simply say for now that the most important feature of late Qing scholars' attitude toward China, an attitude that was well described by Rebecca Carl in her book Staging the World, is the idea that India was a lost country and that China ought to do whatever in her power to avoid enduring the same fate. Considering the problem from the standpoint of education, at the beginning of the 20th century, scholars such as Kong Youwei and Zhang Taiyan show interest in native Indian school of thought like Brahmanism, but they never went into deep study. Hopefully, at the beginning of the 1910s decade, things were moving in the university system. Thanks to the impulse of Cai Yuanpei, a course on Indian philosophy was opened in 1917 at Beijing University. Liang Shuming was appointed professor of Indian philosophy, and 2 years later, he published an outline of Indian philosophy. The Indologist Alexander von Stell-Holstein, who emigrated to China after the October Revolution, also taught Sanskrit, history of ancient India, and the philosophies and religion of ancient India at Beijing University from 1922 to 1929. However, the most important Beijing-based scholar was probably Liang Qichao, who devoted a lot of work on the question of the relationship between China and India, especially regarding Buddhism. Aside from these, we could say, specialists who were interested in Indian culture, one has to notice that simultaneously the Chinese intellectuals were increasingly aware of the growing Indian nationalist movement. According to an Indian scholar, over 65 articles covering different aspects of Indian national movement were published between 1905 and 1948 in the Eastern Miscellany. A peak was attained during the civil disobedience movement, and a special issue was even devoted to Gandhi and modern India. Brian Tsui's research on Gandhiism points in the same direction. It shows that Chinese intellectuals took the Indian freedom movement seriously, and that the Indian nationalist struggle served in China as a medium to interrogate Western modernity as a social and cultural formation. However, did the Chinese really spoke of Indian culture? I have some doubt about that. I did a small statistical survey. I wanted to check how often a Chinese reader could read anything about Indian culture in Chinese, Indu Wenhua. At that time, Wenhua had become the most popularized concept to speak of what we tend to call culture. The results are quite surprising. Limiting myself to only the Eastern Miscellany, which is supposedly a journal favorable to India, one finds no article specifically dealing with what we could call nowadays Indian culture, except perhaps one text on Vedic literature. While searching the whole text, I found only three articles mentioning the words Indu Wenhua between 1904 and 1937. No book were ever published on the topic of Indu Wenhua. And we have to wait for 1926 to see the first publication of a general history of China in Chinese. Ancient India was still vastly unknown before Tagore's visit to China. And I should add that during the entire Republican era, much of the historical and anthropological knowledge on China was accessed via Western mediation, whether by but the knowledge was accessed via a Western mediation, for most of the books were translated either from the Japanese or from the English. The only two subjects that directly captivated the attention of the Chinese in the 20s were the great figure of Tagore and Gandhi. I will start with Gandhi. Chinese had much interest in his non-cooperation movement. Brian Tsui advocated that the Mahatma was regarded as a Lenin of the East. As I said before, a special issue of the Eastern Miscellany was dedicated to him. However, in the text, except one article, nothing was said about Gandhi's criticism of Western civilization. For example, one author gave a short presentation of the Brahmo Samaj movement, depicting it as a fierce opponent of the invasion of Western capitalism and Christianity, and he placed Gandhi in its continuity, but exclusively as a social reformer. The only text to present Gandhi's position was an article on his principle of satyagraha. However, I have found not any text quoting or discussing the position developed in this article. I believe this raises an important issue. It is one thing to pinpoint a Chinese translation of Gandhi, but it is another to clearly identify a discussion about the text. And in the present case, I didn't find any. Perhaps more documents need to be excavated from the extensive number of periodicals in the Meifei era, but from the time being, it seems that Indian criticism of Western civilization were not discussed by key Chinese intellectuals. The issue also gave me the opportunity to dwell briefly on the problem of Tagore reception in China. Despite his being at the center of the research, of much of the research, much of the study dedicated to the Prophet of Asia have only focused on his 1924 trip, and not much has been said about the reception of his cultural discourse before 1924. And I have here discovered troubling documents. Sadhana, The Realization of Life, the book that popularized Tagore's cultural discourse in the West and in India, was translated into Chinese in two times, once in 1921 and in 1922. The second text was accompanied by a full study of Tagore's philosophy. It is therefore highly probable that the Chinese intellectual interested in the Indian poet would have read this book, but once again, I could not find yet any mention of this book among the key intellectuals of the period. Many Chinese intellectuals presented Tagore as someone who could inspire the young Chinese, someone who had a strong stance against the West, but they never entered in the details, they never discussed his position. Having made several remarks on the state of Indian studies and the reception of Indian culturalist discourse, we can now turn back our gaze to the specific features of the Chinese discourse on Indian culture. I should precise here that I'm mainly dealing with popular intellectuals and not specialists working on ancient China. And to say the truth, I didn't find that many at the period. Having browsed many documents, I would like to attract your attention to two specific features. First, India was almost always associated to religion. Indian civilization or culture, Wenming or Wenhua, both words were used, was often characterized as a culture focused on religion. For instance, in his essay on the digestion of civilization, Cai Yuanpei stated that the philosophical richness of India's civilization had been stained by the foul smell of religion, and hopefully, when China digested India, she did not convert to this kind of religious belief. Chen Duxiu also considered the Indians' religious beliefs to be stupid and responsible for the modern demise of India. I should add that at that time, Chen and his New Youth Journal were the paragons of the fight against religion. Even someone like Liang Shuming accepted the judgment of India being a religious country. In his Culture of East and West and their philosophy, on which I will come back soon, he wrote that the vast majority of Indians do not want to preserve their lives. They usually want to leave the world. They call it nirvana. This situation was not to help or to improve the place of Indian culture in the spectacles of Chinese intellectuals. The second feature was that China had already absorbed the Indian culture. For Hoshi, like Kang Youwei before him, China had digested the Indian culture during the Six Dynasties. Therefore, all the good things that the Indians could have passed to the Chinese. Let us take a look at this, I would say, peculiar figure taken from Hoshi's History of Chinese Philosophy. Here, he produced a very bold figure to explain that modern Western culture is the result of the Roman absorption of Judaism, while Chinese culture, since the Song Dynasty, was the result of the absorption of Indian Buddhism. In this specific slide, he speaks about philosophy, but one has to keep in mind that at that time, philosophies were understood as the center of cultures. In this figure, Indian culture is not only reduced to Buddhism, but in the same time it was implied that there was nothing of value aside Buddhism in Indian culture. That is what I would call a very narrow-minded approach. As a matter of fact, Indian culture was not that much belittled because of a specific analysis of distinctive features, but often through what I would call a rhetorical dismissal. That is what I would like to show you here through several quotations from less famous author. First, with Chang Naider. Chang Naider produced in this slide a summary of what people, usually in China and in Japan, used to say about Eastern and Western civilization. He didn't share their opinion, and he was simply here quoting their position in order to criticize them. I would like to raise your attention to the third point, in which India is completely scrapped in a very, very chauvinist way, saying that Eastern civilization originated in China and Japan is quite troubling for me. I would say it is very unsettling because in this Chinese chauvinist appropriation, the world Asia is based on a complete blindness toward the other. In criticizing these points, Chang Naider never raised the problem of India. It doesn't disturb him that India is not in this affirmation. As a matter of fact, the rejection of India was almost never based on any argument, except, of course, for the classical lostness topos that ought to be avoided for China. Let us briefly look at two other intellectuals. First, Zhang Junmai, who in 1922 wrote an article on the crisis of the European culture. In this paragraph, we see that at first he opposed the Eastern and the Western culture, but next sentence, the Oriental, the Eastern culture, turns into China. It's a completely unsettled shift. The opposition between the East and the West is only an opposition between the West and China. Chen Jiayi is also a very good example. In his article, Eastern Culture and Our Historical Responsibility, he shed light on four qualities of the Oriental culture. But here again, there is a glitch in the reasoning. The four points he puts forward always dismiss India. We don't even need to enter in the arguments. Just see how he speaks about India. In the first section, he writes, the Eastern culture, this section concerns especially China. In the second section, the Eastern culture, this section can only be a little valid for India. The third, also only China. And the fourth, a little bit of India. But in the section 2 and 4, there is no example about India. In his development, it is clear that Chinese culture is what is the most important. India is not important at all. She is not even discussed. Chen was completely aware that he was supposed to describe an Oriental culture. However, not integrating India didn't lead to any remark about the problem. Instead of putting forward a unity of the people of Asia, the very notion of Dongfang Wenhua or Dongfang Wenming, it is both valid for both, implied a dismissal of India. Dongfang was a synonym of China. However, at a time when the East-West dichotomy was paving the intellectual field, one book changed, or at least tried to change, the framework. In 1921, Yang Shuming published a volume in which the West, China, and India were apparently put on the same level. Liang's books was perhaps the most important document to take seriously Indian culture in the early 20s. The core of Liang's book could be summed up as follows. For Liang, every culture, like every life, enter itself in a fundamental will. This will can be oriented into different direction. Facing the problem of life, man can either go forward, adjust one's intention, or turn back and move backwards. Besides, Liang notes that life takes place in three different realms, the material, the social, and the spiritual. This typology starts off his approach toward Indian, Chinese, and Western cultures. They are all distinguished by an attitude toward the world. With its will to go forward, the West has focused its culture on the material world. Chinese culture, with its will toward harmony, epitomized the adjustment of one's intention in the social world. Finally, Indian culture turns back and moves backwards to address the problem of the spirit. In Liang's understanding, Eastern cultures are not lagging behind the Western. They simply took a different path. He even turns out upside down the thesis of the backwardness of Eastern culture. For him, they are in fact in advance. The best road would be to first deal with the material problem, then the social, and then the spiritual. The problem with the Chinese and the Indian culture is that they are ripe too early. They focus first on the social and on the spiritual problem. So Liang calls for a cultural reorientation. He thinks that China ought to focus herself on the material world, that means adopt Western culture. But once the material life is at ease, China will have to go back to its own cultural trajectory. Finally, in the future, when both the material and social problems are handled, she will have to walk the Indian path and solve the spiritual problems. In Liang's eyes, Indian culture was therefore not appropriate for present time, but it will be in the future. From this perspective, Liang did not belittle Indian culture. On the contrary, India was located at the nexus in Liang's soteriological discourse. In the end, India will free the entire mankind. However, let us enter in the detail and observe what Liang's Indian culture is really. First of all, Liang accorded a great importance to religion in the formation of culture. But in the case of India, it was not any religion, it was only Buddhism. How come Liang Shuming, a professor of Indian philosophy at Beijing University, could only associate Indian culture to Buddhism? Did he have any clue about the six traditional Indian school of philosophy, or perhaps even Jainism? Liang knew of the six traditional schools, for he had presented them in his outline of Indian philosophy. However, it is obvious that this book had been written from the perspective of a Buddhist, for he described the six traditional school as heretical path. Why Tao? I think here that Zbigniew Wisolowski, a specialist of Liang Shuming, is the best to condense in Liang's position in the following paragraph. Indo-Weisha Buddhist culture is a culture whose basic direction of the will is to negate itself. Indeed, it is more correct, I believe, to do like Wisolowski is doing, and not name the Indian culture an Indian culture, but clearly an Indo-Weisha Buddhist culture, because that's only what Liang Shuming is talking about. Considered from the tripartite framework, Liang's attitude toward India may have seemed positive, but in reality, if we enter in the details of the text, India was still a failover. Let us read this long quotation. Let us take a look at Indian culture. A material civilization has produced no success, and a social life has not known any evolution. Regarding these elements, she does not attain Western standards or even China's. In her culture, there is nothing to talk about. Her only accomplishment is religion, and her philosophy, literature, science, arts, all depend on it. As to the free realm of light, she has produced a twisted development towards spiritual life, and among the many aspects of a spiritual life, she has also warped advancement toward religion. This is really awkward. Despite the fact that Liang had saved India from the East-West dichotomy, his attitude toward her shared in the end much with his contemporaries. Liang was not interested in an anthropological study of India. The only Indian culture he spoke about was in fact what India has transmitted to China. Of course, it would be anachronistic to ask him to write long page on the Adivasi, on the Indus civilization and the Vedic, but one could expect a more balanced view, especially for someone who knew about ancient Indian philosophical school. To conclude, it seems that neither Indian culturalist discourse nor Indian culture were objects of interest during the May 4th era, which is quite surprising, for Kang Youwei and Zhang Taiyan at the very beginning of the 20th century had shown an interest in ancient China. The situation would hopefully change in the 30s, in which one can notice the emergence of a more abundant academic literature concerning India and increased political exchanges. In the 20s, Chinese intellectuals spoke abundantly about Eastern or civilization, but they had a new vocabulary at hand to describe the phenomenon that contemporary academics locate under the categories of culture and civilization. At that time, the concept of Wenhua was omnipresent in the debates. But they did not use it to speak about India. The statistical absence of Hindu Wenhua in the Eastern miscellany speaks for itself. The only notable feature was the statement that India was a land where religion held much importance, something that downsized a position in the eyes of anti-religion, anti-superstition intellectuals. If the economic and political situation of India would attract the attention of political thinkers and actors, Indian culture was forgotten. In fact, she was not dismissed by arguments, but by rhetoric. Chinese did not speak directly about Indian culture. They speak about the Eastern culture, but in the end, Eastern culture was Chinese culture. If I still have 2 minutes, I would like to end on a quotation of Liang Shuming. In his Culture of East and West, he had the following comments. For 2 or 3 years, because of the so-called new culture movement, we all have a mouthful to say and an inkpot to write about words such as culture of the East and the West. However, although everyone keeps speaking about it, does it mean that we have a real comprehension of it? In my opinion, not everybody understands what the culture of the East and the West are. People just casually talk about it. Liang is harsh with his contemporaries, but he simultaneously raised a very important issue. The word Eastern culture and Western culture were often used without serious background inquiry. People spoke of Eastern culture without having any knowledge concerning India. Liang opted to correct this defect in presenting his philosophy of culture. Yet, here again, we know that his understanding of India was very partial. Thank you very much for your attention.